session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette King Clinton Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning. This morning we have on Richard Teigen versus the Wisconsin Elections Commission 22 AP 91. Could I please have your appearances? Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Bessenberg, Wisconsin Institute. We're the plaintiff respondent petitioners with the council table. It's my colleague, Ruth Berg.
Good morning. Very good. Good morning. It's my understanding, and I'll just put the timing out there so we don't have any questions about it. I want to make sure this is your understanding as well, that we have 12 minutes, 12 minutes, 12 minutes, followed by 40 minutes and 5 minutes, and then a very short 3-3-3. Is that correct? Okay. These time periods go awfully fast, so good luck. And with that, we will begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. In an attempt to organize that short time, Chief Justice Ziegler, I am going to endeavor to speak primarily about sovereign immunity and ballot return assistance. Mr. Curtis is going to speak primarily about drop boxes and standing, and Mr. Kilpatrick will speak about rules versus guidance and also about drop boxes and ballot return assistance. Let me begin by saying that sovereign immunity precludes the adjudication of this lawsuit. As the court knows, the state can be sued only as the legislature expressly authorizes. That's in Article 4, Section 27 of our Constitution.
Counsel, you are representing the only party to raise the issue of sovereign immunity. Isn't it odd that the state itself is not raising that issue?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I would rebut your premise a little bit. Every party on our side has raised the issue. We are the party that has taken the lead in arguing the issue. But it is in every party's answer. If you look at page 65 of the joint appendix, you will find it in our answer. If you look at page 54 of the joint appendix, you will find it in the Elections Commission's answer. If you look at page 35 of the joint appendix, you will find it in the DSCC's answer. And it is not... It really, in some ways, Your Honor, doesn't matter. This is a constitutional command. The legislature alone has the authority under the Constitution to allow the state to be sued. It is not up to the Elections Commission or, respectfully, to the Department of Justice to somehow waive that. That is not a principle that applies. And the precedents of this state make that clear. The Kuchman Court decided that this was a jurisdictional defect. Whether we call it jurisdiction or competency, it is a constitutional command that cannot simply be tossed aside.
Well, you raised standing as support for your argument, counsel, but standing is very different in Wisconsin state courts than it is under the federal system. Can you explain for me what you think the difference is?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. Standing is a separate defect with this lawsuit, but is truly separate, as you say. Sovereign immunity goes to the constitutional authority to sue the state. Standing is, in this state, a prudential matter about whether we have the right plaintiffs before us. But that is a completely different issue that, as I said, Mr. Curtis is going to address in more detail. The sovereign immunity problem here is much more significant. The state has, the legislature has, in Wisconsin Statute 5.06, set out a detailed and exclusive method for challenging election procedures in this state.
How does your position square with Chapter 227, because Section 227.40 says the exclusive means of judicial review of the validity of a rule or a guidance document shall be an action for declaratory judgment brought in circuit court?
Well, there are a couple of issues there, Justice Bradley. First, it is the case, and it is chapter and verse black letter law, that the specific statute governs over the general statute. So even though Chapter 227 is the general manner for challenging a guidance document or a rule, the specific statute here, 5.06, which was adopted later, so the legislature was aware of 227, governs. And secondly, Chapter 227 really doesn't fit here. Now, this is where we start to also come into standing, but under 227.40, subdivision 1, quote, the court shall render a declaratory judgment only when it appears from the complaint and the supporting evidence that the rule or guidance document or its threatened application interferes with or impairs or threatens to interfere with or impair the legal rights and privileges of the plaintiff. That brings us right back into the standing problem. The plaintiffs here have no legal rights that are being impaired. So even if the court thought that 227 was a proper jurisdictional vehicle, it cannot support the judgment that was issued below. 5.06 is the right way to go, and the plaintiffs knew this, and we know that they knew this because their lawyers filed a complaint under 5.06 with the Elections Commission about these exact same issues on behalf of a different plaintiff the same week that they filed this lawsuit.
I'm not sure I agree with your premise that 5.06 is the more specific statute that would prevail over the rights that are expressed in Chapter 227, because Chapter 227.40, Section 227.40 specifically mentions guidance documents, which is what is being challenged.
Well, Your Honor, I understand, but if you look at 5.06 Subdivision 1, which deals with breadth of what can be handled in a 5.06 complaint, it is incredibly broad. It deals with any matter concerning, and then there's a whole list of things, including any action taken or not taken. And certainly the issuance of a guidance document is an action taken, or the failure to promulgate a rule is an action not taken. 5.06 is specific to the election statutes, and 5.06 sub 2 is quite clear that it is exclusive because it says no one who could file a complaint, right? And any elector, any voter can file a complaint under 5.06. No one authorized to file a complaint may commence an action or proceeding in court to test the validity of any decision, action, or failure to act with respect to any matter without first filing a complaint under Subdivision 1 and without the resolution of that complaint. Now, the respondents here have suggested in briefing that it is good enough that there is this other case proceeding through the courts.
Counsel, I want to... This 506 thing is really fascinating, right? You have the statute that describes an election official as anyone who's charged with any duties relating to an election in 5.01. The very next definition, though, is 5.025 in the Elections Commission as a sort of separate entity. It strikes me as odd that as far as statutory structure, that when the Elections Commission does something that any problems with that would have to go through the 5.06 process. I'm wondering if, the Elections Commission, when it acts, falls within that definition because it is separately defined immediately after that section. And obviously the process is a little odd, right? You have to go to the Elections Commission. So it is a little odd to think that you'd have to go to the Elections Commission to find out whether the Elections Commission has violated, some law.
I don't think, Justice Hagedorn, that that's as odd as it might initially seem. There are plenty of places in our administrative law, and we talk about this in our reply brief, where when you're unhappy with an agency decision, you go back to that agency first, because they haven't necessarily had the benefit of your argument. They haven't heard what you have to say. And we know that this is a fairly routine thing. We know it's been done. After the 2020 election, when one of the commissioners And one of the architects of the commission when he was in the legislature, Dean Knudsen, was unhappy with something the commission had done. He filed a 5.06 complaint. Actually, two of them. And those were adjudicated by the Elections Commission. So I don't think that's really odd at all. I think it really comes back to this court's order last summer in the Fabic case, where this court said that judicial process matters and that the court must consider the law, including the processes the legislature has enacted governing when and how election challenges can be made.
True enough. And there we had somebody who brought a complaint suing the city of Madison, Waukesha, you know, for how the Madison, you know, clerk was operating their elections, which is a very interesting matter. I want to get your response to 227.40 in the last sentence, which says a declaratory judgment may be rendered whether or not the plaintiff has first requested the agency to pass upon the validity of the rule or guidance document in question. That language would seem to not have the same sort of normal exhaustion arguments that were raised. The same sort of jurisdictional bar. It seems like the and again, feel free to push back on this, does not have the same bar when you're challenging the validity of a rule or guidance document, that you don't need to go to the agency first, and it explicitly says so.
Well, again, Justice Hagedorn, we've got a couple of problems with that, including that 5.06 was promulgated later, including that Kuchman has been the law in this state for 30 years, and the legislature has not, although it has reorganized Chapter 5 extensively, although it created the commission, and before that the Government Accountability Board, and before that the State Elections Board, all of which are since Kuchman, and it has really amended these statutes heavily. It has at no point said that Kuchman was wrong or tried to change it. And we still have the problem that I was discussing with Justice Bradley earlier, that the plaintiffs here are not aggrieved. They have no injury. And so 227.40, even if it would provide jurisdiction, cannot grant them relief. I see that I'm running short on time. I'd like to very briefly discuss ballot return assistance before my time expires. Wisconsin law does not, and Wisconsin law cannot, prohibit ballot return assistance. Plaintiffs here, or respondents here, advance a misreading of Wisconsin Statute 6.87, sub 4, paragraph B, 1. The plain text does not require an elector to personally mail or deliver an absentee ballot back to the clerk. It uses the passive voice. The punctuation completely contravenes the plaintiff's meaning because they ignore the comma placement. And this court's own precedents, going back almost 70 years, look at nearly identical language and say that ballot return assistance is perfectly lawful. To say,
are you talking about the Summerfield case?
I am, Your Honor.
Yeah, let's talk about that case. It's an interesting case. So you have 18 ballots that are delivered by somebody else to the clerk in that situation, and the question before the court, as I read the opinion a couple of times trying to make sense of it, is whether those should have been counted in that circumstance. And the court, sort of says, well, listen, some things are mandatory, some things are directory. We're going to read this as directory because we think the legislature wouldn't have wanted these people not to vote. Then you have three dissenters who say, well, no, the statute says that. But if the question is whether it's mandatory directory, holding that something is directory and therefore even though it wasn't strictly complied with, we're going to count the votes, still seems to necessarily mean that they read the statute to say it needs to be, it's supposed to have been delivered in person. And because it wasn't delivered by that person, it actually violated the statute, and the court is saying, no, we're going to count it anyway. So I thought Summerfield cut the other way in terms of the reading of the statute than what you present.
My time has expired. May I answer
you
Justice
may answer,
Hagedorn's
thank
question?
You.
Justice Hagedorn, I would respectfully suggest that that's a misreading of Summerfield, and here's why. Summerfield really deals with, as you say, the question of whether this provision of the law at that time was directory or mandatory. But what it does is it lays out what it would mean to have a directory statute and what it would mean to have a mandatory statute. It says quite clearly that a mandatory statute is satisfied by substantial compliance, that a directory statute doesn't even need that, And then at the end, after looking at the whole thing, and after deciding that reading the statute the way to prohibit those ballots would be completely absurd, which is also true here, the court essentially makes a two-part holding. It says, we conclude, therefore, that in order to fulfill the spirit of our election laws, so that's the directory statute part, the last sentence of 11.59 is directory only, and this is separate, and if you look back at how it sets up the mandatory and directory with the quote from the Nebraska Supreme Court about the mandatory statutes and then the quote from Corpus Juris Secundum about directory statutes and that a delivery of ballots by an agent is substantial compliance therewith. So what the court has done is said, even if it's mandatory, we've got a sufficient answer. And I will endeavor to address this on rebuttal, but subsequent cases applying Sommerfeld confirm that reading.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Curtis.
Good morning again, Your Honors. I'm going to focus my remarks on the legality of drop boxes under Wisconsin law, and then we'll briefly address the plaintiff's standing. And one additional point about ballot return is not addressed by Mr. Mandel. As to drop boxes, it's important to emphasize that the circuit court did not forbid the use of all drop boxes. To the contrary, it ruled that drop boxes are perfectly legal if, number one, they're located at the office of the municipal clerk or a properly designated alternate site, and number two, are staffed by the clerk. Plaintiffs have not challenged that part of the circuit court's ruling on appeal and have conceded that drop boxes are perfectly lawful in these circumstances.
Counsel, whether they're lawful or not is a question of law, and I'm sure you realize we don't accept concessions of law from parties. That's our job, to decide what the law requires.
I understand, Your Honor. And I'm going to focus, if I may, on two questions. One, whether a drop box must always be located in the office of the clerk, and number two, must a drop box always be staffed? As to that first question, the key language, of course, is in 6.87, which provides that an absentee ballot shall be delivered in person to the municipal clerk. It says nothing about delivery to the office of the municipal clerk.
How would you get it there if you didn't have the address of the office on the ballot you mail?
How would you get to the...
How would the ballot get to the designee without the address of the clerk on the envelope?
Well, where the ballot is returned to a drop box, the drop box will have been publicized.
Okay, you're not reading the statute. I'm reading the statute, okay? And you can deliver them by depositing the ballot in the mail.
Yes.
Okay, you agree with me on that part. Okay. How is that ballot going to get to the municipal clerk without the address of the office of the municipal clerk on the envelope?
It would be delivered in person to the clerk or
okay,
an office.
You're not listening to my question. Let's try to communicate. One way that you can do it under the statute, I think you just agreed with me, is put it in the mail. Put the ballot in the mail, okay?
Correct.
I am responding to your argument that there's nothing that requires the office of the municipal clerk to be involved in this. My question to you is to that premise that you raise. My question to you is if I'm an absentee voter and I put my ballot in the mail, how's it going to get to the municipal clerk without the address of the office of the clerk? That's the question.
And if you put it in the mail and with the clerk's address,
right.
It will reach the clerk at the office.
Hey, Curtis, are there two options here? Is one that I, when I am casting my ballot, I could mail it, or do I have a second option as far as the clerk's office or a drop box is concerned?
Yes, that's right. There are two options, and the second option is delivered to the clerk or the clerk's authorized representative. And in contrast to many other provisions in the election code, we counted 31 of them. That provision doesn't refer to the office of the clerk, but simply delivered to the clerk or the clerk's authorized representative. And under the exclusio unius canon of construction, that's an important distinction. If the clerk has designated a drop box, say a staff drop box, in front of the municipal building or at the curb where people can drop that off, that is delivery to the clerk. Similarly, delivery in a drive-thru in a parking lot or in any high-traffic area that the clerk has designated, that would be delivery to the clerk. The legislature knows how to say deliver the ballot to the office of the clerk. It has used office of the clerk in many other places. And again, that's a distinction.
Are ballot drop boxes an alternate absentee ballot site under statute 6.855?
No, they are not alternate ballot sites. An alternate ballot site is one where a voter may request, vote, and then return the ballot in one stop. A drop box obviously does not do that.
Under what provision of the statute are they permissible then?
Drop boxes under section 6.87.4b, the delivery to the clerk. That is the operative provision.
Counsel, you did not cite, as I saw it, the 32 statutes that you are now proclaiming that the legislature wrote at the office. I recall about five or six, and one of them I read the others, printed this one, and this is 6.15, new resident presidential voting. You really don't need to have it before you for me to make my question. It states, except as authorized in 6.797, when making application in person at the office, and that's your point. All of these that I looked at had at the office or in the office. And your point, I think, is the relevant statute doesn't have that, and why?
I'm sorry, what was your
last? The relevant statute doesn't have the words in the office. Now, you refer to some canon, Latin canon of construction. Actually, I prefer passive voice and comma arguments, but nevertheless, I'll fall in with that. Of what moment, then, is the surrounding statutes say at the office and this one doesn't?
What is the statute you cite?
Right here. There's several of them.
Well, I mean, you cited, I thought, 6.79 sub 7, which is license surrender.
6.15.
Sub 2 says
sub
procedure.
Sub 2 BM.
Procedure at clerk's office.
Yeah. The new residence presidential voting. There are several of them. They're cited in several
Well, just as Bradley, the moment of that is that if words or phrases are used in some sections of the code, but not in others, the court must conclude, that's this court's language, must conclude that the legislature specifically intended a different meaning. And so delivery to the clerk must be given a different meaning than the office of the municipal clerk.
And the different meaning that you would give it, counsel, as I understand your argument, is that the municipal clerk can authorize representatives without any limitations, without any regulations, so that basically anybody can receive a ballot, an absentee ballot, in any place, as long as the municipal clerk says that's my designated representative.
No, there are a number of limitations on what the clerk can do. The plaintiffs, for example, talked about, well, if my argument is right, then you could have a shoebox on a park bench. And that's wrong for at least two reasons, it seems to me. First of all, that's not authorized by the commission guidance. That would flatly violate.
Well, the guidance isn't the law, though, right?
No, you're correct, Justice Bradley. But guidance is defined as a guidance document provides guidance or advice with respect to how the agency is likely to apply a statute or rule enforced or administered by the agency. So the shoebox on a park bench, a voter files a complaint with the commission under 5.061, I think we have a pretty good idea of how the commission is going to turn out. But more, even more important than that, there are a number of statutory limitations on what the municipal clerk might be able to do. And just to give three, if I may briefly, Section 6.84 discusses the importance of carefully regulating absentee voting to prevent the potential for fraud or abuse. Section 7.15 obligates the municipal clerk to have charge and supervision of elections, to properly conduct elections, and to ensure that elections are honestly, efficiently, and uniformly conducted.
Counsel, what does the word in person do in your reading of the statute? Delivery to the municipal clerk, they could have just said that, right? And there's, I understand your position to be that municipal clerk is any potentially site designated by the clerk for receptacle for ballots. What does the word in person do in your reading of the statute?
Our reading, Justice Hagedorn, is that in person refers to the deliverer. The deliverer, the voter or the voter's agent, must either mail or deliver in person the ballot to the municipal clerk. And the clerk, the recipient, certainly has discretion to say, bring it directly to me. But just like with an in-person delivery, the recipient can also say, well, put it through the mail slot if
so
I'm not there.
If my local, you know, political party, picks up ballots, picks up my ballot and brings it to the clerk's office, has the ballot been delivered in person to the municipal clerk, under your view?
The political party?
Let's say political party stops at my house. I give my ballot to the political party. They take that. They bring it to the clerk's office. Has my ballot been delivered? Has my ballot been delivered in person to the municipal clerk, in the words of the statute?
With one caveat, I believe it has been. If the ballot has been sealed and not tampered with, I would say yes.
Every dictionary that I consulted for the definition of in person said it means by oneself or something similar. So how can it be that somebody other than the elector can deliver the ballot in accordance with the statute?
Well, that's a question that Mr. Mandel is addressing, the question of delivery. But I would argue that, a voter may designate an agent to do that delivery for them.
Where does it say that in the statute?
The statute does not refer to, in that provision, to agent. I wanted to mention, if I could, one other point. I was mentioning several restraints.
Your time is really up, so I think you have to, and we went a little beyond it. 12 minutes goes fast. You'll have to do it on rebuttal.
To be continued.
Okay,
thank you.
Counsel, were you planning to address standing? Because I did not get an opportunity to ask your friend on the same side my standing question.
I was not, Your Honor. Okay. It is true
I'll wait for rebuttal.
Okay. It's true the commission raised standing, but did not push it in.
Are you standing by those arguments that they make? because I think Justice Bradley raises a really interesting question. I've never seen an intervener raise arguments on behalf of the state. The state's not arguing that. Well, I mean, maybe it's happened before. I just haven't, don't recall seeing it. It's an interesting posture.
Well, to be consistent, we did not take a position on it one way or the other in briefing, and I'm not going to take a position on behalf of the commission in oral argument either. So it's a no position type of response for standing and for sovereign immunity, because although we raised it, we're content with the other parties pushing that forward. We chose for strategic purposes to focus our briefs on other things. So
that leaves me perplexed.
Okay.
Do you agree with their standing and sovereign immunity arguments, even though you are not advancing them? I don't want to necessarily pin you down, but I do want clarity. So,
revisit
that answer, if you will.
I understand you don't like the non-answer that I provided, but again, the position of the commission is we raised them in the answer, but we chose not to put forward them in our brief. We did not choose to adopt by incorporation or by reference those arguments. We didn't say we are in disagreement with them either. Our focus on this was a challenge to guidance documents that the commission issued in response to requests from municipal clerks about whether drop boxes were allowable.
So do you agree they can be challenged under 227?
We did not raise or file any type of motion to dismiss that 227 was improper. We saw this as a 227 challenge to the memorandum, and it's the commission's position that these are guidance documents and not administrative rules, as the plaintiffs have pushed and as the circuit court has held. It's our position, the commission's position, that to accept the reasoning of the circuit court that anything the commission publishes or issues simply because it has broad powers over the administration of elections would have the effect of law, ignores statutes that specifically say when something the commission issues has the effect or force of law.
Counsel, did this court get it wrong in Trump v. Biden then when it said that the WEC's guidance was the rule book for elections?
When it said it was the
rule book for elections, WEC guidance.
Well, the rule book and whether it is an administrative rule, I think, is a different question.
The problem that I'm seeing, and the municipal clerks actually filed a brief saying, look, we need guidance. We need answers to these questions. WEC provides that guidance, provides those answers to the questions, and the municipal clerks, regardless of how WEC frames its guidance, that's what the municipal clerks do, is how I read their brief. So, in effect, what happens is that the guidance, which I agree with you, guidance does not have the force of law, in effect, in reality and in practice, it does become the law that governs the elections in the state of Wisconsin, even if it conflicts with the statutory mandates from the legislature.
Well, that is up to the municipal clerks. As this court well knows, we have a decentralized system in Wisconsin, and it is up to...
Doesn't the argument of you and counsel, though, don't those arguments leave a lot to chance? I mean, shouldn't we expect more, and don't the statutes expect more in the voting process? Consistency and predictability and understandability. I mean, doesn't that leave a lot to the discretion of who happens to be on an unelected elections commission board, and also what a municipal clerk tends to think they can do under certain guidance? It leaves a lot to chance, doesn't it?
Well, I think a better way to put it, the way I would put it, it allows discretion to those municipal clerks on how to conduct the elections. And that's what the statutes, I think, are created in a way that allows municipal clerks, they're the ones who administer the elections. The election commission can provide guidance. The commission memos did not say you must follow these these memos.
Does the guidance require that rural municipal clerks, and I happen to have a soft spot in my heart for rural municipal clerks, some of us do, right, who may be working 4 hours or 5 hours a week, period. Does it require that they have drop boxes, or is that left to the discretion of the over 1,800 municipal clerks in this state?
Right. That's where the discretion comes in, and that's where the statutory language comes in, too, which my friends on this side have stated, that the legislature decided to use the term municipal clerk and not the municipal clerk's office or the clerk's office. Again, there are a wide variety of clerks in this state, some in cities, some in rural places, and they may not have an office, a municipal office. Some may be at a home. Office hours may be different. So it shows that there is there's discretion. It gives discretion to the clerks on how they think to best administer the election. And that is given, that is concluded by the plain statutory text, which the commission looked at prior to giving that guidance. The envelope shall be mailed by the elector or delivered in person to the municipal clerk. Granted, does not say drop boxes, but again, it does say municipal clerk and not the municipal clerk's office. So therefore, there's giving discretion to the municipal clerk to set up these secure drop boxes as a way for absentee voters to return their ballots.
But isn't the exercise of that discretion, of course, subject to statutory mandates as well as the legislative policy that is expressed in 6.84, which says the privilege of voting by absentee ballot, and of course that language says there is a right to vote, but the right to vote absentee is a privilege. That exercise of voting by absentee ballot must be carefully regulated to prevent the potential for fraud or abuse.
Yes, that's true. And there are safeguards throughout the statutes on how to fulfill that policy. And it's the commission's position that once there is a ballot in a sealed envelope, that it is allowable for that elector, if he or she chooses, to have someone else deposit it into a mailbox, take it down the driveway into a mailbox, or deposit it into a drop box. That is based on the plain statutory language. That's the commission's position.
Counsel, this is challenged below, and the circuit court decided that what the WEC did was to create a rule, but they didn't do the rulemaking process. And I know the argument is made, well, this doesn't have the force of law, and that's how a rule is defined. That's conclusory. If I looked at something WEC did, since 1979, this court has given three things that if they occur, what's going on is rulemaking. Are you familiar with the citizens case and our decision in Palm, which laid out the three activities that if they occur, rulemaking is going on?
Unfortunately, we didn't focus on Palm. Our position was that the effect of law is the only factor that we're challenging here.
But that simply is conclusory. Okay? You're saying it's a guidance document. It doesn't have the effect of law. I can read the definitions in the statute, too. I mean, that's where that comes from. But if you just look at the case law, back to 79, it says, if it's an action of general application, there is a class that's described in general terms, and new members can be added to that class, it's a rule that you're putting out because it affects those three things. Now, are those three things affected by the memorandums that were sent out, I think the last one was probably in August from WEC?
Well, I would take the position that what you have said about what is a rule doesn't take into account what the legislature has done recently with the creation of guidance documents. The guidance documents are very similar to rules, but they don't have the effect of law, and that's the difference.
But that's conclusory.
Okay.
If I say it's a rule, I'll agree with you. If it's a rule, it has the force of law. If I say it's a guidance document and you and I agree on that, I will agree it doesn't have the force of law.
Mm-hmm.
That's a conclusion. That's a legal conclusion.
Okay.
That doesn't tell me how I evaluate what WEC has done to determine, well, did they make a guidance document? Or did they make a rule and they didn't go through the rule process? That's what's bothering me
okay.
about this.
Well, what I would say is that the commission, either the commission or through its administrator, issues a lot of written documents.
Sure.
And one is an election manual for the clerks. And I believe that that is a guidance document. It's not a rule. If the circuit court's reasoning were to be affirmed, then simply everything that came out of the commission's office or the administrator's office would be deemed a rule. And
I think that's a little broader than what the Supreme
okay.
Court talked about.
But in any event, that's the commission's position. The commission does not think that everything it issues has the effect of law. It issues orders under 5.06. It issues advisory opinions that have the legal effect or the legal force of law. Those are when the commission issues something that has the effect of law, not when it issues memoranda that it specifically
but
said
your
is
argument
guidance.
Lets the commission be the doer and the decider of whether he did it, whether they did it correctly. You realize that? Because your conclusion says it doesn't have the force of law, therefore it can't be a rule. Well, that lets the person that took the action decide the case, right?
Well, not quite sure where you're going with that. Yes, the commission acts as a quasi-judicial body, right, deciding cases before it, and the guidance can show what it may decide. Of course, those are always subject to judicial review. The commission does not have the last say at that. A 5.06 does have 227 review. And I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Essenberg.
May it please the Court. The Wisconsin legislature has provided for what is often called no excuse absentee voting. Not every state does this, and Wisconsin is under no obligation to do it itself. At the time that it did this, and over 30 years ago, it made clear that its extension of no excuse absentee voting created a privilege and not a right, and that the provision of this form of voting, in which a substantial portion of the process would be taken outside the supervision of election and commission officials, lacks many of the traditional safeguards associated with voting at the polling place. For that reason, the legislature enacted a relatively comprehensive scheme of who must do what in order for an absentee ballot to be cast and counted. And it specified, well after Sommerfeld, that these provisions that it created for this new, no-excuse absentee voting were not directory, but mandatory, that they must be followed, that votes that were not cast in accordance with these provisions may not be counted. Now, in this particular instance, the legislature has provided two means for the return of an absentee ballot.
Counsel, I'm going to just jump in here. The mailbox question, can you point to me where in the guidance that WC issued that's before us? I don't see anywhere, and I'm happy to be corrected, but in reading the two memos that are the subject of this dispute, I don't see any language that deals with mailing ballots. I recognize it's part of the statutory argument in terms of what it means to be delivered in person to the municipal clerk, but I'm not seeing anything in here that actually addresses mailing. And the circuit court obviously addressed it specifically. Could you point me to the language in the memos that you feel like makes that an issue? Because this is a 227 action, so the only thing we're talking about are these documents. We're not here to just do, you know, sort of free-floating, election advice.
I think the things that were done in the guidelines is that the guidelines taken as a whole did two things. First of all, it provided for the use of drop boxes, which I think it's fair to say, reading the memos, have to be locked in some way. But after that, there's a lot of different options. They should be staffed. They should be monitored, but they don't really have to be. That certainly is a departure from either mailing a ballot in or delivering it in person to the clerk. The guidance also said, the second guidance also said, that ballots could be returned by anyone, implying that ballots could either be placed in the mail by anyone or ballots could be picked up and delivered to the clerk's office by anyone.
Yeah, but that was in response to the question, can voters return an absentee ballot they received by mail in person at the clerk's office, in-person absentee site, or their polling place on election day? And then the guidance here says ballots can be returned to the clerk's office, yes, and a family member, another person, may also return the ballot on behalf of the voter. That doesn't seem to have anything to do with mailing ballots. I understand that there might be connections to it, but, I'm wondering whether this just, it doesn't talk about mailing at all. I understand it's connected in reading the statute, but do we need to decide, put a fine point on it? If I'm mailing an absentee ballot and my wife takes the three steps to put it in the mailbox rather than me, have I violated the law? Do we need to decide that question?
I think you do. And I think for this reason, I think that language is broad enough. And this is an issue is often referred to in this case. Does anybody really care if a spouse returns a ballot, on behalf of, someone in his or her household? And the problem, of course, is that the statutory scheme enacted by the legislature is relatively comprehensive. It places
sure.
the obligation.
The statute says what the statute says. We should follow it. My question is not, my question is, do we need to decide it? I don't see it. I don't see it here.
I think that the WECA guidance is broad enough to suggest that it believes that because a ballot can be returned on behalf of the voter, that the ballot can be placed in a mailbox by the voter, and that would, of course, include paid activists, paid canvassers who go around and collect ballots and place them in a mailbox.
Is there any evidence of that in this case, Mr. Essen?
We don't have any evidence in this case because of the procedural posture in which it comes to us. We didn't take discovery, but I don't think that that's pertinent in deciding what the statute means. The legislature, in this instance, went to great lengths to ensure, and I think the best statement of this is paragraph 54 of Justice Hagedorn's concurrence in Trump versus Biden, where he recites the plain meaning of the statute. And he said, under the law, when a voter requests an absentee ballot, the voter must return the absentee ballot in a sealed envelope by mail or in person to the municipal clerk issuing the ballot or ballots.
Right, Mr. Essenberg, when we talk about shall be mailed, the legislature, and words matter, and we're looking at what the legislature said about it. What does it mean, shall be mailed? Does it mean I can take it down to the mail room? Does that mean that I physically have to walk to the end of my driveway? Doesn't shall be mailed leave room for, it's a passive voice that leaves room for all kinds of processes of the mailing. Does that mean I'm handing it to the mail person directly? Can I stick it outside my house? Shall be mailed. We have to look at the words, right?
I think that what the statutory language says is that the envelope shall be mailed by the elector. So although we have moved to the passive voice, the statutory language clearly is still concerned and very much not indifferent as to the actor. It wants that ballot, that envelope, to be placed in the mail by the elector. Now, it's true Justice Dowd, as you point out, there are a number of ways to place something in the mail. You can put it in a public mailbox. You can put it, in my understanding, is that when I go down to the end of my driveway and I place an envelope in my mailbox and I put the little flag up that I have placed that ballot in the mail, nobody better take it out of there. If I hand my ballot to a mail carrier, I have now placed it in the mail.
Hey, you keep saying placed it in the mail.
I have mailed it.
I'm reading shall be mailed. Mailing is a process, and it is not defined. So why isn't shall be mailed the process of the elector undergoing the process of getting it in the mailbox? It doesn't say how.
I have mailed it. If I take the action which is necessary to place this envelope in the mail.
What if I take my envelope and I seal it and I stick the stamp on it and I put my return address on it? And I am standing at the mailbox, and I hand it to my son to go the arm's length from where I am standing into the mailbox. Have I mailed? Has that been mailed by the elector?
Well, within the meaning of the statute, no, because you've given the ballot to any. You've given the ballot to somebody else. Well, now,
Mr. Rosenberg, I know. I'm sure you can appreciate how absurd that result is.
It's not absurd, because I think we have to distinguish between something that we regard as absurd, that is logically impossible and making absolutely no sense, versus something
that fits the bill for me, I have to tell you.
Versus something that we think is overly stringent and perhaps not as convenient as we like it to be. In this instance, the legislature has decided that much as you must go to the polls yourself, you cannot send an AP. You cannot take your son with you to, help you fill out your ballot and deliver it to the clerk. You must do it yourself. The legislature has tried to replicate that with respect to absentee balloting. Now, it may well be, and in fact, the bill that was passed by the Senate and vetoed by the governor on Friday did say that a spouse could or a immediate family member could return a ballot. It may be that you could structure a system of absentee ballot in that way, and nobody would have any particular objection.
Counsel.
But that's not what the legislature has done here.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you to give a little bit of an alternative argument, if you have one, trying to, hit the point that you want to make. In part, I'm going to ask this because I do see some absurdity in the position taken that I can't have my husband walk to the end of the driveway and put it in the mailbox. And I use in comparison our rules of appellate procedure. Our rules of appellate procedure and the order for briefing in this case, right, say the appellate must file with the clerk. And then the respondent must file or shall file. Does that really mean that the petitioners in this case have to file it in the clerk's office? Do they have to personally mail it? And as an attorney, now, in your office, I don't know how you do things, but in a lot of attorneys' offices, the attorneys who are agents of the respondent or the petitioner assuming representation, the attorneys, we sit back and we sign things and then give it to someone to take care of it, to take care of the filing. But the law says the respondent shall file, the petitioner shall file, and of course the agent can do it as an attorney. But you don't file things, I would guess. I would guess that at least in many offices, and perhaps even yours, you leave it to someone else to take care of those details. So isn't that inconsistent with the law?
Justice Bradley, honesty compels me to say that were I to be asked to physically accomplish a filing in my office, it
would be beyond
it you, would perhaps. Not go well.
Yeah, that's right. I know exactly it. So
however,
that's why your interpretation touches on the absurd, and I don't want it to be absurd. So give me an alternative that makes it at least less
right.
Absurd.
I think this is different because we have a process with respect to the filing of litigation on behalf of an appellant or a respondent in which we know that there are a number of people involved. There are lawyers and paralegals and secretaries, and we expect them all to be involved in the process, and this isn't an exercise of a personal or individual right by collecting a vote. But here we have far more specific statutes, and the statute says, the relevant statute here says, that this envelope must be placed in the mail by the elector.
That's not what it says.
I'm sorry, it should be mailed. I apologize.
You know,
it shall be mailed by the elector.
It's important, Mr. Essenberg, because mailed is defined as to send by the nation's postal system. To send is defined as to cause a letter or package to go or be carried from one person to another. That is a much broader definition than the one you are trying to impose and the one the legislature imposed.
I respectfully disagree because the statute says that this must be mailed by the elector. The statutory language, even in passive voice, is quite clearly concerned with the identity of the person who is doing the mailing. It must be the elector. And what the defendants want to argue here is that this means that anybody can do this, that the envelope could be given to the local union steward, it could be given to the local Republican Party activist, it could be given to somebody who passes your house on the way and says, would you put this in the mail for me? And that seems to me to be inconsistent with the clearly expressed legislative concern that given the absence of traditional safeguards, we want this to be mailed by the elector.
Counsel, could
we want
you
it to be delivered in person if it's not mailed.
Could you address the argument that this would violate the absurdity doctrine? Because as I understand that doctrine, absurdity doesn't mean that judges or justices think what the legislature wrote is not a good idea. Is that your understanding of the doctrine?
Absolutely, and as I attempted to say earlier, absurdity does not mean I think it's inconvenient or I think it could be done in a better way or I don't see any reason why it has to be as strict as as it is. Those are all legislative choices. Absurdity means something which simply won't work, can't work. It's illogical. That is when the doctrine applies, but
Mr. Essenberg, isn't that exactly what the court said in Sommerfeld when it said, if our statute is construed to mean that the voter shall himself, and I'm going to add and her or herself, mail the ballot or personally deliver it to the clerk, then the statute would defeat itself in the case of those who are sick or physically disabled. They would be unable to mail ballots except through an agent. Having made provisions that these unfortunate people can vote, we cannot believe that the legislature meant to disenfranchise them by providing a condition that they could not possibly perform. Didn't the court already say that the argument that you are putting forward simply won't work or is illogical?
No, I don't think that makes it, that would not make it illogical. That might make it if, in fact, there were persons who were unable to mail the ballot or deliver the ballot in person, that might make it impossible for them to vote, and that might create some legal problem down the line. That doesn't mean that
might
the statutory...
Might create a legal problem down the line. How would they ever challenge that?
Well, if I may, I'll get to that. It would not cause the statutory language to be absurd. It may cause the statutory language in certain as-applied instances to run afoul of other legal commands. Under those circumstances, those individuals, perhaps they would have a claim under the voting rights. Perhaps they would have a constitutional claim. I would say that on this record, however, we have no indication that such a person exists. Because we have affidavits here in which individuals have indicated that what they need is essentially somebody to pick up their ballot for them.
Wait, are you saying we don't have, but Mr. Us, Are you saying that what we don't have is an example of someone who might not be able to physically mail their own ballot?
We have examples of individuals who have indicated that they need somebody to pick up their ballot for them, but we know that it is possible for such persons to mail a ballot. We know that it is possible for them to arrange for pickup from the United States Postal Service if they are disabled. And so if you need someone to pick up your ballot for you, there's no reason that it can't be a mail carrier.
But what I'm hearing you say is that if someone is disabled and cannot get to their mailbox, they cannot have someone else take the envelope and put it in their mailbox.
They can if it's a mail carrier, just in the same way as I can mail something, I can place something
but
in the
mail carrier doesn't
whichever
come.
Term you want to use, by giving it to a postal carrier.
We've spent a lot of time talking about what the mail provision might be, but if you could go back to the guidelines and how that works as mailing or doesn't. What are the guidelines? That's what's at issue. The two memos, the guidelines here, and that's what's been appealed under 227.
Right. I apologize if I don't get exactly what you're asking, but you'll let me know if I don't.
We've gotten into all sorts of examples of what might be unfair in a mailing process and personal situations that may or may not be good under your interpretation. Having said that, we're here to discuss whether or not these ballots can be deposited in things other than the mail system, right?
Right.
Okay, so if you could get back to that, I think that's of interest to the court as well.
Right, so putting aside, a ballot must be placed in the mail, it must be mailed by the elector. There are a number of ways in which that can be done, and we've talked about that. Failing that, the ballot must be delivered in person to the clerk.
And is that what the guidelines talk about?
The guidelines contradict that. The guidelines say that a ballot may be delivered on behalf of someone else, like it should be delivered not in person. And the guidelines also say that a ballot may be delivered to a drop box, which is not delivery to the clerk.
Counsel, I want to run through a few situations so I can understand kind of the exercise in line drawing here. So hopefully most of these are yes or no, and maybe that's unfair, but please indulge me if you're willing. So I want to imagine you're in the municipal clerk's office, business hours, staff is present, and there's a slot where you put a ballot. Is that okay?
I don't mean to be. I know you said you wanted yes or no answers. I think it might depend where the slot is. I think if the slot is staffed by the clerk, and so we're trying to figure out what it means to deliver to the clerk. And so obviously, if you go in and you hand the ballot, you put it in the clerk's hands, you deliver.
Mm-hmm.
It may also be, although ultimately the decision is for this court to interpret the law, it also may delivery to the clerk if I were to go up to the clerk's counter. The clerk is standing there staffing the counter. I place the ballot on the counter.
I was imagining like a one of those little mail slot windows behind
the
screen.
The key here is I have to somehow transmit the ballot to the clerk in the presence of the clerk or the clerk's employee. So, and that's important because if I do that, the clerk will A, know that it happened, and B, know whether I have done something wrong. The clerk will know whether I have, delivered 14 ballots.
But the clerk know it was you.
Well, let me just keep going if I could.
Can I ask a follow-up to that question before you move on?
Sure.
How would the clerk know that it was you? How would it know that you are the same person who is delivering?
So an issue not presented in this case is whether the clerk has a requirement to verify the identity of persons who are delivering ballots in person. That's not presented in this case. My own view is that they can do it, but there's no statutory language that requires them to do it. But then again, that goes back to the scheme that the legislature has enacted. The legislature has decided how strict and how unstrict it wants this scheme to be.
There's also nothing that authorizes, you're saying that allows them to do it, but there's nothing that would authorize them to ask anyone who is submitting a ballot for identification, correct?
I'm not sure that the language that says that a ballot must be returned in person to the clerk wouldn't authorize them to identify that person. I don't think they have to do it. I don't think that issue is presented by this case because it's not raised in the guidance, but I think that they would certainly be within their rights to do that.
Just to keep going on my questions here, if I could, briefly. Same situation inside the clerk's office, staff during business hours, freestanding drop box. Clerk says, all right, looks good. Go ahead and put your ballot in there. Is that okay?
I think that a drop box that we can say is staffed by the clerk. It is in the presence of the clerk.
Okay.
A clerk can see what's going on.
So that's good.
I think that would be delivered to the clerk, although, again, it ultimately is for this court to decide.
So, now you're in a municipal building. Where I go vote, the municipal clerk's office is inside the broader municipal building. Okay? And imagine a mail slot connected to the clerk's office, but staff's not there. So whenever the building's open, you can walk in. Can you drop a ballot in that slot that goes directly to the clerk's office? Is that okay?
No, I mean, at this point, we are now outside the presence of the clerk.
Okay.
So the delivery would not be in person.
So for you, essential is staff present. Is that right?
With respect to that aspect.
Okay. So what if there was in the front of the clerk's office and where I vote during the spring elections too, there was a drop box outside at the municipal building. Okay. And what if a clerk's staff was standing next to that drop box and walked up and said, yes, you can put your ballot right in here. Is that acceptable? It's at the same physical location where the clerk's office is. It's not inside the physical office, but it's at the building. It's outside the building. These are real questions, right? These are real questions and need to be answered. So I think it's really important that we define this carefully and not generically. So is that okay?
Well, line drawing is always difficult.
It is.
The question there for us at least would be, is this box still within a designated absentee ballot site or the clerk's office? And I think that, you know, if I can see a court concluding that if the box is, outside a door that says clerk's office on and the clerk is standing there, then maybe that's okay.
Okay.
But that creates a more difficult question.
But I think you had
at some point now we've departed too far from what the statute clearly refers to.
Right. So I assume then your answer is if I move that drop box staffed to the library, you would say that's not okay because it's not where the office of the clerk is. So to understand the lines you're drawing, I just want to make sure I understand. Lines you're drawing are needs to be staffed when the ballot's deposited. It needs to be like roughly at the clerk's office or an alternative site under 6.855. Is that a fair way to characterize where you're drawing the lines?
I think that's fair.
All right. So, Mr. Essenberg, going to exactly where those lines that you're drawing are, the language in the statute, which we have to look at the words that the legislature chose, to the municipal clerk, it does not say the municipal clerk's office, which it does apparently in 32 other places. So to the municipal clerk, why couldn't you have a box with a municipal clerk or their representative, because that's how clerk is defined, anywhere else with that person standing there? Or, alternatively, why couldn't I hand it to my municipal clerk as I see them walking down the street in a small town? Oh, I meant to mail my ballot. I see you. I'm going to hand you my ballot. Under this language, what is wrong with either one of those scenarios?
I think with respect to your first hypothetical, Justice Dowd, I think that one could have a clerk staffed absentee ballot site.
Okay, I'm not talking about
status. And
are you talking about 6.855, which is
yes.
Not what we're talking about, because that's where you get out, where you take a ballot, vote, and return. So I am not in the realm of 6.855.
So what I would say with respect to that is that the statute provides for the creation of an alternate absentee ballot site in which ballots can either be received and voted or returned. It provides for nothing else. There is no other site that can exist.
Oh, okay.
And so if we're going to have another site, it has to comply with 6855, whether we allow both activities there or only one.
Okay, 6.85 does not give alternatives to activities. All of those activities have to take place, and that is not what we're talking about. We're talking about returning the ballot to the municipal clerk, delivering the ballot to the municipal clerk, and not the municipal clerk's office. But you want us to read into that language, from what I hear you say, municipal clerk's office, because you're saying nothing else but something on the premises of the office of the clerk is acceptable.
I think that the existence of 6855 itself evokes a legislative intent that this activity can take place only at certain locations that are officially and properly designated, that where there's public notice, where there's public input, whether there's a requirement, a legal requirement of even-handedness. I do not believe that a clerk's office, that the clerk can or the clerk can designate somebody to go door-to-door and pick up ballots or set up a back table at the old-fashioned and pick them up there. I don't think that that's what the statute contemplates.
But Ms. Hoffberg, what about
the existence of 6855?
But I think Justice Dallet is talking about 6.87 sub B sub 4 sub 1, which the language there is the return out enveloped shall be sealed. The witness may not be a candidate. The envelope shall be made by the elector or delivered in person, comma, to the municipal court issuing the ballot or ballots.
Yes, I agree that's what 6.87.41b, but it has to be read in conjunction with 6.85.55. And that does place some limitations as to where this activity can be.
But isn't 6.855, if I am voting, if I am going somewhere where I'm going to cast my ballot, where I'm going to fill out the form and then send it in right away, that's 6.855. 6.87.4b1 is for when I get the ballot sent to my house, for example, I fill it out and then I need to get it back somehow, but I haven't done that at a 6.855 alternate site. I have done it in my kitchen and now I'm going to get it back. Why? It doesn't put all the restrictions of that return that you are talking about in response to Justice Hagedorn's questions.
That's true, but the statute
says to the municipal clerk.
The statute doesn't authorize a place where only that can happen either. I think that the legislature has gone to the trouble of setting forth procedures for the establishment of an alternate absentee ballot site in 6.855, where these activities relative to absentee voting can take place. Impels a conclusion that they don't take place anyplace else.
Counsel, I look at 6.855 and I see it as applying to early in-person absentee voting. Do you agree with that?
That's one of the things it applies to.
Here's a hypothetical. Assume that in the township where I used to live, assume that the office hours were Tuesdays and Thursdays from 2 to 5. Assume that this person works in Madison and isn't always in the township. So this person wanted to deliver an absentee ballot and on the weekend went over to Betty's house, who's the clerk, and gave her the ballot before the Tuesday election. Is that an illegal vote?
I think because of the existence of 6855, there's a very serious question as to that vote. The legislative scheme here is designed to place to replace what the legislature has identified as traditional safeguards.
The legislative scheme, as I read 6.855, applies to the whole process. of voting. But I'm talking just about delivery. This hypothetical person would have voted in her kitchen and then driven a half mile to Betty's house to drop it off. Is that an illegal vote?
I think 6855 applies to both in-person absentee voting and return of a ballot that is obtained elsewhere, you know, that is sent to you or something like that. I don't think that the use of the conjunctive rather than the disjunctive in that statutory provision means that you can do anything else you want.
Well, the answer to my question is yes. It is an illegal vote.
I think it would be.
I think if the League of Wisconsin Municipalities are listening to this oral argument, they might have wished they had asked for some argument time. I need to explore with you what it means to deliver in person to municipal clerk, because there's a lot of talk about the office, the physical office of the municipal clerk. But the municipal clerk is also an office holder. What I'm hearing from my colleagues is a suggestion that the voters in a municipality can ring the doorbell of the municipal clerk's house all day and all night, and the municipal clerk needs to answer the door and receive the ballot, or the municipal clerk, while he or she is out on a shopping trip, must also collect ballots if they are handed to him or her. Is there anything? There's got to be something in the statute, I think, if we give proper meaning to municipal clerk, that would prohibit the municipal clerks from being harassed in this manner. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree, and I think it's 6855, because here's the thing. Of course, if you looked at 687(4)(b)(1) and you stopped, you might say, well, you know, I guess you can give it to the clerk. Maybe you can give it to the clerk wherever the clerk happens to be found, or the clerk can go wherever she wishes. But I don't think that the statutory scheme, read as a whole, contemplates or even permits that type of capaciousness with respect to absentee balloting. I think that 6855, which also exists, and provides, it says, okay, you can have an alternate site, and here's how you do it.
Is there anything?
And I think that means you don't have one another way.
Is there anything in the statutes that suggests that the municipal clerk must be available to voters 24/7 during the election cycle? I mean, this is an office holder who, yes, has a place of office, but there's got to be some reasonable limits in the statute on when he or she is expected to exercise those duties and be responsive to constituents. Voters.
Right, and that's, I think, where you find it.
So other than 6.855, you have no argument as to why we should read to the municipal clerk as to the municipal clerk's office, despite this statute not saying those words and despite those words being used in 32 other places in the statute but not here.
I wouldn't put it that way. I would say that, if you took 687(4)(b)(1) and you stopped, then I might agree with you. But 6.855 exists and has to be given meaning as well.
So the answer is yes, that's the only thing you rely on.
6855.
Counsel, could you address the standing argument that's been advanced? It is suggested that your clients, the petitioners, the plaintiffs, do not have standing to bring these claims in the first instance, and we should dismiss the case on that ground.
I think that we have a right to challenge this guidance document under 227.40. Our voters clearly have an interest, and in fact, 506, although its procedural requisites don't apply here, recognize that voters of the state of Wisconsin have a right to ensure that the elections in which they participate are conducted lawfully. And so under 227.40, we have the right to bring this declaratory judgment action. And as this court recognized in Trump versus Biden, the time to clarify these issues and give clerks and voters guidance as to what may and may not be done in an election is now. It's not in the middle of the election. It's not after the fact. It's beforehand, so that when we go to the polls in a contested process where we know that somebody is going to be happy and somebody is going to be sorely disappointed, to the extent we can, We have let the people of Wisconsin know what the law permits and what it does not permit so that they can have a greater degree of confidence that the election has been fairly conducted.
Just to follow up on that, counsel, the statute in 227.40 talks about the legal rights and privileges of the plaintiff. Is your argument that any elector in the state could sort of, for the same interests or consonant with the interests that are sort of recognized in Chapter 5 when bringing a complaint against a, you know, an other election, that would enable essentially any elector to challenge a rule or guidance document of the Elections Commission as a sort of a general rule? I think that's what you'd be advocating, at least under that. Is that a fair statement of your position?
Sure. Just as one could challenge a clerk's decision under 506, one can challenge a guidance document or rule of, and any elector can do that, so can any elector challenge a guidance document or rule promulgated by the commission under 227.40. And then there's taxpayer standing.
Counsel, I was just going to ask that, and taxpayer standing. So what's your argument on taxpayer standing?
Well, the actual taxpayer standing is you know, even a slight amount of the expenditure of taxpayer funds in the state of Wisconsin can support taxpayer standing.
Let me just distill this. I understand your argument on taxpayer standing is that because an employee of WEC is spending time doing this, that's an expenditure that causes you a direct injury. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Counsel, if your taxpayers...
Could I ask a question?
Please, yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. Do you wish to address at all whether these documents and memoranda are rules?
Yes, I think they're rules for the reasons set forth by Justice Rogensack. They are general rules of general applicability. What WEC has done here is they've created an extra statutory way to return ballots. Now, I think that that is a general rule of general applicability. We learn elsewhere in the record, this caused, you know, in excess of 500 drop boxes to be present in the state of Wisconsin. If this is not a rule, I don't know what is. It is a general rule of general applicability which authorized something which is not otherwise present in the statutes. That's a rule.
Does every part of this these memos, then, you think they all have the force of law, that all local officials need to follow every word of them? The statutory prerequisite to a rule is, nobody argues it's not a general statement of general applicability interpreting the statute. The only question here is whether it has the force.
Yeah, my light has gone out, and I'm going to ask permission to answer.
Yes.
I think that they have the force of law, not by requiring clerks to do this, because because WEC didn't require them to do drop boxes, but WEC authorized them to do drop boxes, and I think that in this instance did have the force of law. It was I think one can conclude that it was a general rule of general applicability.
All right, thank you, Mr. Troupas.
May it please the court, I first want to thank Will and Rick Essenberg for granting me this brief amount of time to speak directly to the court. One of the things that was asked about just a moment ago was, boy, it's a shame that the league is not here as well. In many ways, Senator Johnson, he has a not dissimilar position, although one says it supports one side and one says it supports the other. Senator Johnson here is on a very practical problem that occurs when we simply don't know what the rules are. Justice Hagedorn's comments about all of the varieties of ways in which you could interpret this, or I would suggest Justice Dalit's comment about, well, could you just give it to a specific person in the grocery store or whatever, wouldn't that satisfy the statute, beggars the question, which is certainty. 6.84 could not be clearer in requiring that you must be carefully regulated. That absentee ballot must be carefully regulated. So in interpreting these statutes, as this court must do, and the question of what constitutes in person to the municipal clerk, it is reasonable to ask the question about what specifically will the rules be with regard to that. It's a very simple answer, it seemed, up until recent times, when COVID or opportunistic behavior made us go to this mass of drop boxes, which could be put anywhere without any restrictions. There are no rules, there's only guidance. We saw in the reply briefs the repeated comment, these are not rules, these are just guidance. Do whatever you want, which means that from a practical standpoint, if these are not rules, if this provision of the statute allows drop boxes everywhere, under any circumstance, that from a practical standpoint, Senator Johnson and any other candidate must meet with all of the 1,800 clerks in this state and ask them, what are you going to do? And by the way, they can say, I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to say where they're going to be. They'll just turn up. And then you can run to the circuit court and you can argue whether that's efficient and uniform operation of our election laws, because that's WEC's response. In the end, that they have argued that no matter what, we trust the clerks to do it right, and it'll be good enough. That's not good enough. That's not what the statute says. The statute says, and a reasonable reading of this statute says, that it must be either in a mailbox or it must be in person in the municipal clerk's office. I think that's pretty clear to most people, and it's only when we dance on the head of a pin or we have some kind of systemic use of grammar that we lose sight of that.
Oh, hold it. Let's not attack use of grammar so quickly, okay? let's just take a look at that sentence that you're referring to, 6.87. Now, you said it in your words, describing it, that it meant included office. I don't see the word office in
correct.
There.
Correct. Office is not there. That it is not there.
And
when one reads this statute, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say. We could have added lots and lots of language.
Like the legislature did in several other statutes, well, that said at the office.
And in fact, 6.84 requires that this court, when it looks at language involving absentee ballots, must ask the question, is this careful regulation?
I asked the question whether this was careful drafting of the statute.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
I asked the question of whether this was careful drafting of the statute, because I've read the sentence, as I'm sure you have.
Many times.
Scores, four scores and more than that.
He's not that old.
No, that's the number of times I'm sure he read the sentence. I'll tell you, if what you're doing also, it seems to me, counsel, is reading words into the statute. Not only does office not exist there, but the way that you're reading it is, the envelope shall be mailed by the elector or delivered, and you're inserting by the elector, but it doesn't say that. That's the whole argument of the passive voice, which doesn't identify the actor, which is part of the definition of a passive voice, not identifying the actor. And
unfortunately, 5 minutes goes really fast for a question that takes up more than half. Are you going to land the plane? We need the question so he can answer it. His red light's been on for some time.
May I add one thing, Justice, to your question, Justice Bradley? When the statute has some level of ambiguity to it, we have, of course, a whole series of construction rules. But there's one rule here that WEC simply won't acknowledge, which is rulemaking. In fact, we point that out in our amicus brief, that there was a simple answer here. It shouldn't be up to this court. If the language may have this level of ambiguity, that's why we make rules. That's why WEC sits down with the legislature, as they should have done during the COVID period of 2020, when everybody was on board on these things, and come to some reasoned basis for a rule. This court can direct that. This court can direct that they sit down and work out a rule, and that the court will not rule on this matter until they have done that or a certain date ends. Force the parties to be adults and address this question so that we can have it, if there is that ambiguity. I happen to think there isn't, but others on this court think there is. And some think that you should have it anywhere. So thank you very much. And again, on behalf of Senator Johnson, I want to particularly appreciate the opportunity to speak.
All right. Thank you. All right. 3 minutes is going to go very, very fast if 5 minutes went that fast. So.
Counsel, I'm going to start asking the question since you only have 3 minutes. I'm going to speak really fast. I want to zero in on what I perceive to be a problem with your definition of in person, which I understand to mean could also include an agent. In other words, the envelope could be delivered by an agent instead of the elector. We have this in-person language in other statutes, specifically 6.80 sub 2 sub e, with respect to voting in person. It says, upon voting his or her ballot, the elector shall publicly and in person deposit in the ballot box. Also, an elector shall apply for registration in person. If we accept your definition of in person to include agents, that would also necessitate us saying that I could have my agent vote in person for me or register me to vote. Could you address that, please?
I disagree, Justice Bradley, and I was planning. I want to talk about two things, and one of them was to answer the question you had asked Mr. Curtis earlier, and he deferred, which is this question. That's really about absurdity, right? To take those places and read in person, to say that when a voter votes in person, they can send an agent, that doesn't make sense. And Mr. Essenberg takes issue with the use of this court's precedent or the use of some members of this court saying that to read 6.84 as he does is absurd. But I disagree. It was only 8 weeks ago that this court issued an unanimous decision in Bray, which talked about absurdity as being nonsensical in paragraph 16 or incongruous in paragraph 18, and said that literalness may strangle meaning in paragraph 11.
That's not a literalness, and I wrote that opinion,
yes.
So I'm
yes,
very familiar with it. That is not a strict construction, because these are closely related statutes, and Kalal instructs us, as do the canons of construction, to read statutes in context and to consult the surrounding statutes, and so it would strike me that it would violate at least several canons of construction were we to give a different meaning to in-person with respect to absentee voting than we would give to in-person voting.
Well, I understand where you're going, Justice Bradley, but it would violate several other, it creates several other problems to read it otherwise. It violates this court's settled precedent and the fact that the legislature has ratified that by continuing to revise the statutes but not changing this language over the last 70 years, and it would create a preemption problem with federal law. Those are huge problems. I would also note, while we're talking about the breadth of the statutory scheme here, the statutory scheme is quite detailed for voting in this state, much more so than it used to be. And yet there were some questions from Mr. Essenberg about how it is that municipal clerks are supposed to verify that the person returning the ballot, may I finish my sentence, that the person returning the ballot is the actual voter. And he has no answer, and the reason he has no answer is there is a gaping silence in the statutes. That silence speaks volumes. There is no, I would suggest to you, equivalent silence about something that that the statutory scheme would really require to make sense anywhere else. And that's because the legislature has never understood the statutes the way that they read them. let me just conclude very quickly by saying that we would urge the court to reverse the court below, which entered a permanent injunction on no record at all. Mr. Essenberg himself noted the lack of a record, but he said it was because of the procedural posture which he and his clients created, while ignoring three major legal issues: sovereign immunity, preemption, and equal protection, which we didn't even get to talk about today, and no record evidence to support the plaintiffs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I'm going to do the same for you because we've had little discussion about standing.
Yes.
And as I understand your argument, but I'd like you to clarify, are you arguing that the voters of Wisconsin have no legally cognizable interest in ensuring that Wisconsin's election laws are complied with or that WEC properly administers elections in accordance with the law?
No, my argument certainly is not that broad. What we are arguing is that the voter dilution theory advanced by the plaintiffs below has never been recognized in this state. Never. It has been consistently rejected in the federal courts. And I understand, Justice Rogenczak, as you said it at the beginning of the argument, there are different rules of standing in Wisconsin. It is prudential, not jurisdictional. However, as this court emphasized in the McConkie decision and in a number of other decisions, federal decisions on standing are, quote, persuasive authority, unquote. And the only response we've had to those federal decisions from the other side is that they're irrelevant. Those decisions cannot be at the same time irrelevant and persuasive authority.
Well, the foundation is very different for federal. It's they hear cases and controversies, okay? That theirs is jurisdictional at its basis, and Wisconsin has disavowed that over and over. Ours is prudential. It is not jurisdictional.
It is non-jurisdictional. It is prudential. I understand that. At the same time, the court in McConkie, I think unanimously, said federal decisions on standing are persuasive authority.
Who would have standing to bring the claims that the petitioners advance in this case?
Well, there'd be several ways in which that could happen. We've heard about 5.06, and in fact, Mr. Essenberg referred to that as a source of standing here. 5.06 only allows a voter to file an administrative complaint with the commission, and then if the voter is aggrieved by that decision, could go into court. But there's 5.06. There, the an individual voter would have the ability to file ask the district attorney or the attorney general to take action. There are other parties, for example, political parties or candidates might have competitive standing because of competitive injury. And if an individual voter could show that in particular circumstances that she had been aggrieved, individually harmed, she would well have standing. But we're talking here about a theory of vote dilution that says that any voter in the state, their vote is diluted when anyone else is allowed to vote other than in a strict compliance with the law. And that's just never been recognized. Taxpayer standing also. If a taxpayer could show an expenditure made as a result of a challenge decision, the taxpayer could almost certainly have standing. Here, though, as Justice Bradley pointed out, I believe it was you, Justice Bradley, the theory of taxpayer standing here is that, well, someone at the commission on state time using state resources came up with a memo that was wrong. That's not what this court has said is taxpayer standing. Most recently in Fabic versus Evers, the court emphasized there needs to be an illegal expenditure of state taxpayer funds as the result of the challenge decision. And to this day, Plaintiffs have not pointed to any such expenditure result of state tax funds resulting from the decision. I see my time is up, and thank you for your indulgence.
It goes fast. We knew that.
I'm going to speak very quickly. Few points to make. One is that it is true, Justice Hagedorn, that the memos do not discuss mailing at all. The subjects of the memos that are at question here are drop boxes. And only in passing did the commission include one sentence that talked about the return of absentee ballots. So drop boxes are the focus. That also means that 6.855 is inapplicable because that statute talks about in-person drop boxes do not have the aspect of voting. And disagree with Mr. Essenberg that you read that in conjunction, 6.855 with 6.874. 6.87 sub 4 is the only statute that discusses the return of the ballot. That is the statute that this court should look at when determining the interpretation.
Counsel, I want to ask a quick question about kind of the rulemaking guidance piece here. Does the commission answer questions informally to people who ask, and does it do it formally, and what is the process for that?
I believe that there likely are informal phone calls probably from clerks, municipal clerks. But there are ways in which the commission and the administrator issue advisory opinions. And that's in 5.05, I believe. And that's a way to do it officially.
And that's what happened here, an advisory opinion formally issued?
No. Okay. No. There was that needs to be requested. There needs to go through a process. Again, in response to some clerks, but it wasn't under the advisory opinion statute.
So do the commissioners need to approve this kind of guidance before it goes out at all?
Well,
or is this just something that, you know, agency staff prepares as its best judgment when receiving questions?
Well, the record doesn't show what is behind these memos, but the administrator had the authority of the commissioners to issue these memos, and that wasn't at issue in this lawsuit.
Doesn't say that on either of the memos.
No, it does not. It is authored by the administrator and the deputy administrator, but no one's
challenging that, is what you're
correct.
Saying.
Correct. Yes.
Is your position that the only time the agency acts with force of law when it, say, acts under 5.06, or are there other circumstances where it could do something like this, where you think something might have the force of law?
I believe that the only time that something coming out of the commission's office, the administrator's office, would have the force of law is the quasi-judicial decisions of 5.06 orders and the advisory opinions under 5.05 by the commission. Those would have the force of law because under the orders, those are directory. These memos are not directing the clerks to do anything. A 5.06 order certainly would. And the statute itself in 5.05 states when an advisory opinion has legal effect in force. And I see those 3 minutes went by very quickly. So I simply ask that the circuit court be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for very interesting briefs and oral arguments. We had a lot of questions for you and comments for you, and we appreciate your taking our questions and comments and doing the best you could with them. So with that, the court will meet in conference shortly, and I wish everyone a good day.